Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming today on this holiday weekend. Special welcome to any newcomers. Newcomers always enrich our practice, so it's nice to have you here. If you are looking for a way to celebrate and honor this nation's fine tradition of organized labor, we have our monthly temple cleaning right after service today. And everyone is welcome to attend and participate as you're able. We meet usually for about an hour, a little bit over. And it's an important service to the community to keep our temple practice ready. We're also in need of, I'm Jaquito, and we're in need of members to serve on the Jaquito Rio, which is a monthly commitment helping clean the temple, and perhaps a meeting or two outside of that during the year. So if you're interested in that, please contact me. Thank you for that, considering that. So today I want to talk about taking refuge in the three treasures. The three treasures, also called the three jewels or the three gems, are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And taking refuge is a practice that many of you are familiar with. It's a very simple practice to engage in, either alone or in a formal, organized group setting. At its most simple, it is no more than wholeheartedly repeating, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha, over and over. Here at Clouds, we take refuge during the morning service when we chant, I take refuge in Buddha, may all beings embody the great way, resolving to awaken. I take refuge in Dharma. May all beings deeply enter the truth, wisdom like the sea. I take refuge in Sangha. May all beings support harmony in the community, free from obstruction. And those of you who have had the experience of sewing an arakasu or an okesa know the pleasure of taking refuge with each stitch. That's when I first became familiar with the practice. I take refuge in Buddha. I take refuge in Dharma. I take refuge in Sangha. That's sort of taking refuge on our own, silently repeating that to ourselves, really gives us a sense of the power of repetition. And repetition is a common thing in the Buddha's teachings. It's an oral tradition. And so the Buddha often repeated, he always repeated what he had to teach. Taking refuge is a core practice for those of us who aspire to live the way. And it's not about the words. We know that. But it's also not about the words, because the words can help engrave this on our hearts. It can help engrave the intention to follow the way, to travel the path of practice. It can engrave it on our hearts. Katagiri Roshi calls taking refuge the very foundation of entering the Buddha way. He says, quote, just as Christians are mindful of God in many ways, then if you enter the Buddha way, you must be mindful of the triple treasure. It is such a core practice that the first 120 questions in guidelines for Zen monasteries is, do you revere Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? That word revere is important. Everybody knows who Dogen was. Dogen was the founder of our school of Zen, 13th century monk. But more than that, he remains a very strong teaching presence in our lineage today. So Dogen points out that this reverence, this awe, is exactly what the Buddhas and the ancestors have transmitted authentically. So I want to tell you why I decided to talk about this. It has to do with a moment of what I can only call Dharma grace that I experienced probably about a month ago. It was a moment of unexpected reverence and awe that had to do with taking refuge. I was weeding a yard in a very lovely South Minneapolis home that was soon to go on the market. I have a friend who's a realtor, and she asked me if I would go clean the place up a little bit. And I was happy to do so because I had recently sold my house and left my beloved garden. And so the prospect of rooting around in a yard was really quite pleasant. But I got there, and it was pleasant for about 10 minutes. It was one of those really humid days, and it didn't take long before I was extremely hot and humid and tired and sweaty, and I started to get hungry, and I was thirsty, and the whole world started to fall apart in the way that our minds sometimes concoct. And I started getting carried away thinking about everything I didn't like. So before long, I got very crabby. I was just flat out crabby. And then I got crabby about being crabby. I'm a Zen priest. I shouldn't be crabby, I said to myself, which did not help anything. So in short, I had gone from experiencing this physical sensation of discomfort to pretty fulsome misery. Maybe that sounds familiar to some of you. But I persisted in pulling the weeds, and I did the best that I could to get control of this very unruly mind. And then, seemingly out of nowhere, refuge appeared. There's no other way to say it. As though it tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hi, sorry to interrupt your misery, but Buddha, Dharma, Sangha here. If you're interested, we're at your service." It was astonishing to me because I had nothing to do with it. I had nothing to do with it. We usually talk about taking refuge, but it was an experience where refuge took me, which is something the Dharma does to us. I experience that every time I prepare a talk. I finally remember, this talk is preparing me. I am not preparing the talk. Dharma makes us lose sight of who is doing what. And refuge took me that day. And it is a practice that I had drifted from in my personal, you know, private life, or that is to say, outside of organized settings. And so I resolved to take it up again. And so I have. I've intentionally and deliberately started taking refuge again. But to have refuge extend its hand that way to me was pure grace. And in the days that followed, I kind of chuckled a little bit, recalling that Suzuki Roshi, another great teacher in our lineage, has a chapter in his book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind called Mind Weeds. And in that chapter, he says, you should be rather grateful for the weeds you have in your mind because eventually they will enrich your practice. If you have some experience of how the weeds in your mind change into mental nourishment, your practice will make remarkable progress. How appropriate that pulling weeds had been the occasion of seeing my own mind weeds so clearly. And so this experience of being taken by refuge prompted me to reflect on this essential practice, and it prompted me to ask, why is it so powerful? Why was the Buddha insistent that we take refuge exclusively in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? What is the source of its power? Who are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in our everyday life? The Buddha said, many of you are fearful of suffering and take refuge in mountains, in gardens, in forests, under trees, or in shrines. This refuge is neither excellent nor valuable. You cannot be liberated from suffering by taking refuge in them. On the other hand, if you take refuge in Buddha, and if you take refuge in Dharma, and if you take refuge in Sangha, you can always abide in the Four Noble Truths. With this wisdom, you always observe and understand suffering and the arising of suffering. You know how to go beyond suffering forever. You know the Eightfold Path. This refuge is the most excellent and valuable of all. You will certainly become free from all suffering by taking this refuge. Now that is a whale of a promise. If you take refuge in Buddha and Dharma and Sangha, you can always abide in the Four Noble Truths. With this wisdom, you always observe and understand the suffering and the arising of suffering. You know how to go beyond suffering forever. You know the Eightfold Path. You will certainly become free from suffering by taking refuge. How do we come to trust this promise? In my experience, and as I understand the teachings, it's pretty simple. We trust it by doing it for ourselves. We verify its truth for ourselves, which is one of the bedrock principles of Buddhism. The Buddha asked us to believe nothing that he taught until we verify it for ourselves. Katagiri Roshi writes that it is impossible to take refuge intellectually. We don't throw away our intellect, he says, but, quoting here, please, just let the intellect join in and practice with it in wholeheartedness. Then spiritual security is present. This is not something we can know, but it is something we can touch. We can touch it directly by putting ourselves right there. And then he gives an example of what he means by putting ourselves right there. I have to put myself right here and talk, he said. Or you can imagine with your families, at work, whatever your situation. You have to put yourself right there and talk. In Katagiri's life, the intellectual world is always coming up, but if I want to give you Buddhist teaching beyond our cultural backgrounds, all I have to do is be present right now, right here, with wholeheartedness, and then talk. Then there is some communion. I can be very calm, I can be composed, and then very naturally, you can be composed and calm. And then communion goes between. This is called taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This communion. Dogen calls it sympathetic communication of the truth. Or in another translation, he calls it mutual affinity and interaction. But it's really all about this very basic dynamic in Zen teaching and practice, which is appeal and response. I've been sitting with this notion of appeal and response which is beyond our usual ideas about what appeal is. We usually think that we appeal for something in particular. I appeal to you for to bring me a cup of water. Or I appeal for an end to my father's drinking, or whatever it is. But Category points out that this goes beyond the sort of particularity of appeal that we're accustomed to. And it goes beyond even individuals. It has to do with the way the universe manifests, including in us, and the way then that the universe responds. I appeal to you constantly for help, Category writes, but this appeal is not to you in particular, it is to the whole universe. Then the response comes from the whole universe. If we feel this spirit of the universe completely and appeal for help, or appeal that we may come alive in our everyday life, then very naturally we can be one with the universe. This is response. In other words, if we reach our hand out to the universe sticks out its hand to us. So it occurs to me that listening, the two essential ingredients to appeal and response is showing up and listening. The older I get, the more I think that simply showing up may be the most important thing that we can do in whatever situation we find ourselves. To show up wholeheartedly, completely, as we are. And to listen then. Listen if there's another person. Listen if there is something in the situation that we need to learn. I mean, how many times have you found refuge in sitting down with someone that you've had conflict with and really talking and listening together? Or forget conflict, in just sitting down and talking with a good friend, feeling really heard. That is the sort of refuge that's available to us. Last night, as I was reworking this talk and reviewing it, I realized that I had experienced a rather remarkable instance of appeal and response in the past couple of weeks. I decided to attend, maybe some of you are familiar with this, Circle of Peace. It takes place Monday evenings at Unity Unitarian Church in St. Paul. It was begun by an African-American couple 8 years ago, I think, who were desperately tired of gang violence and losing friends and sons and daughters of friends. And they decided the best thing they could do would be to invite the community to come together and have a meal and then talk and listen in a structured way. And it was absolutely remarkable. At first, they made it so that only people who had been affected directly by gang violence could attend. And then they decided it was so valuable, they decided to open it up. And they've now met 400 times. So we shared a meal. Anybody who could come. Anybody could come. We shared a meal. And then the facilitator posed a question, which was, tell a story about your mother or father. We went around the room with a talking stick, which was a microphone. No crosstalk. People just talked and listened. Some people told stories about their parents. Other people, there was a young man sitting next to me who lives on the street. He has mental illness. He talked about his mental illness. He talked about how grateful he was to have a place to go because he feels defeated by the street. There were other people who told very funny stories about their parents. There was a woman who really expressed rage like I have rarely seen, directed at what's happening at the border with children and mothers. And we all just sat and listened. We all sat and listened. It really expanded my view of Sangha. Certainly this is Sangha. Certainly the worldwide practitioners of Buddhism is Sangha. That also was Sangha. I was with people who have all resolved to awaken and have taken a step toward doing that. It was as pure an example of Sangha as I could ever hope to have. You know, the original Sanskrit word for refuge is sarana, S-A-R-A-N-A. And what it means is to walk. And it connotes an active seeking out, a wholehearted. It's not something that we can do in our heads. It requires movement, motion, commitment to doing it. This possibility of appeal and response, this sympathetic communication of the truth, is never ending. Dogen writes, taking refuge in the three treasures, you nurture yourself wherever you are, birth after birth, world after world. You accumulate merit, assemble virtue, and attain unsurpassable complete enlightenment. Even if you are misled by unwholesome friends, obstructed by demons, and cut off from your wholesome roots, in the end you will regain them. And then he makes an astonishing statement. The power of taking refuge will never decay. It'll never decay. It is always available to us, whether we leave the path intentionally or unintentionally or not. Indeed, Dogen tells us that the meaning of taking refuge is to return and depend upon. To what do we return and depend? That's a question worth asking ourselves from moment to moment. Upon what am I depending right now? To what have I returned right now? Have I returned to habitual ways of seeing the world and thinking? Have I returned to, and do I rely upon, not the three treasures, but the three poisons of greed, hatred, or aversion, and ignorance? It requires some practice to see these poisons at work in our lives. I recently said to my teacher, Diane Martin, that I felt that I had been doing some wishful thinking about something, and she said, "Oh, well, that's a form of greed." And indeed it is. Seeing, engaging in a fantasy that something is going to turn out the way we want it to because it's the way we want. These are sometimes very subtle. Greed isn't always just, you know, Scrooge McDuck with a big pile of cash that he's hoarding. I've thought several times in the past few years, as the refugee crisis has been in the news so much, that those of us who depend on taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha have a special affinity with those people, with the refugees who have been forced, have been displaced from their homes and forced to seek refuge elsewhere. Because they also have been displaced by greed, anger, and delusion. Greed, hatred, and delusion. They have been displaced by institutionalized poisons. Most of us, some of us, also are a victim of institutionalized poisons, greed, institutionalized greed, hatred, and delusion. all of us deal with it on a personal level. Ignorance and the role it plays in creating suffering cannot be underestimated. And my teacher is fond of saying that ignorance has been dummied down in this culture, which I think is rather funny. But what she means by that is we tend to think of ignorance solely as a passive not knowing of something. Oh, geez, I just was ignorant that that's what I was supposed to do. And when that happens, of course that happens. When it happens, the responsible thing to do is to inform ourselves, right? And so we can react differently, respond differently next time. The more pernicious form of ignorance, though, is making the decision to ignore something and then compounding it, as we often do, by ignoring that we are ignoring. It's like having a bad ache in your leg, deciding to ignore it. Maybe it'll go away. Maybe it will, but maybe it's something you really need to attend to. And then you ignore that you're ignoring it, and before long you have a problem. This kind of ignorance is really worth paying attention to. Because when we pay attention to one thing, of course we often ignore something else. And it's important to see that if we really want to release from suffering. In this way, discontent can become a habit. That's something I'm very familiar with. Discontent can become a habit. The other thing that can become a habit is being discontented with being content. Have you ever had the experience of being perfectly content and this itch comes up? Geez, maybe I should go shopping, or this would be even more perfect if I had a little snack or something. Sometimes it's harder to put down a burden than it is to pick it up. So the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion, have a way of contracting us into ourselves. The three refuges, the three treasures, have a way of expanding us, opening us up to our hearts and to the heart mind of the world in a broader way. The primary ignorance for those of us who are aspiring to walk the way is ignoring our true nature. Or, I think, more likely, forgetting our true nature, forgetting that we are Buddha. If taking refuge is, as Dogen says, returning to and depending upon Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, then it is returning to our true nature. I don't mean to suggest that taking refuge is some sort of magic wand that we just wave, that we just speak the words and it happens. No, it takes effort, it takes discipline, it takes the help of friends, which Sangha provides. And we have to cultivate the path. To take refuge in Buddha means not necessarily taking refuge, not only taking refuge in him as a person, but in taking refuge in the fact of his awakening. The fact that he was a human being just like us, and that with persistence and conviction and help, he awakened, which is the promise that we have in following his path. The Dharma refers to the path of practice that leads to development of these qualities. It's our roadmap. One of the things I am so grateful for when I started practicing was that I was directed to a few key teachings that I rarely understood. But they were compelling because they are beautiful. Our teachings are beautiful. And I highly recommend that you find teachings that speak to you. Find teachings that speak to you so they can show up for you, unbidden even, when you need them. Sangha is the community of those with whom we practice, not just locally, but in all places, and I would say also all times. I think Dogen is alive in this room. Buddha is alive in this room. Our Chinese and Japanese ancestors are alive in this room. Those who are not here are alive in this room. They are part of our Sangha. On the internal level, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are the skillful qualities we develop in imitation of these external models. The Buddha was a person of wisdom, purity, and compassion. When we develop wisdom, purity, and compassion, they form our refuge on an internal level, and we can return to those. When asked why, the Buddha instructed us to take refuge exclusively in these three. He said, you take refuge in Buddha because he is a great master. This is Dogen. Someone asked Dogen. So Dogen responded, you take refuge in Buddha because he is a great master. You take refuge in Dharma because it is good medicine. You take refuge in Sangha because it is an excellent friend. When pressed to say more, Dogen said, these three treasures can cause living beings to get free from life and death and to experience the great state of Bodhi. They are of unthinkable merit. Are you all familiar with the term Bodhi, as in Bodhisattva? It's essentially awakening to one's own Buddha nature. It's the realization of wisdom, or in Sanskrit, prajna. And to me, this is the heart of the matter. It really is the heart of the matter in taking refuge. We do it because it helps us remember we are Buddha. It cuts through our amnesia about that. And it is very easy to forget that we are Buddha. It is very easy to forget that everyone around us is Buddha. And so is this table. And so is everything else. The way is never apart from us right where we are. But it can be hard to see that, and that's why we need reminders. This remembering, this cutting through amnesia, is, in my opinion, the most radical understanding we can have of mindfulness. I worry sometimes in this culture that mindfulness gets reduced to maybe learning how to cut a tomato slowly. Not that there's anything wrong with cutting a tomato slowly. There certainly isn't. But can we go deeper than that? Can we go deeper than that and see our life as the life of the tomato and the life of the knife and the life of all beings? And can we see those things and people as Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? For Dogen, right mindfulness simply meant remembering to keep the Dharma. There's a wonderful essay on right mindfulness that I highly recommend to you. It's in the book, The Eightfold Path. It's a collection of essays on the Eightfold Path by Soto Zen priests. And Judith Biakarin-Regeer wrote the introduction for it. It's a very good book. The essay on Right Mindfulness is by Hoko Carnegis, who is vice abbot at Shanshinji in Indiana. And she writes, not losing the Dharma means not losing touch with reality, not forgetting our true nature and the nature of everything we encounter, not forgetting our vow to save up, to wake up and save all beings. No matter the circumstances in which we find ourselves, we remember that we are Buddha and we are not swept away. When your mindfulness is solid, Dogen says, you will not be harmed even if you go into the midst of the robbers of the five sense desires. It is like wearing armor and going into a battlefield, so there is nothing to be afraid of. So take heart and take refuge. It's important to stay on the path, these days especially. We need to double down on wisdom and compassion. And I encourage you to consider to see taking refuge as a process of discovery for yourselves and for your practice. There's no boilerplate about where this will lead. It will lead you to your own true heart, is where it will lead you. And what that means in your life is up to you. So look on it as a friend and an ally. And use it as the wonderful core practice that it is. Engrave it on your heart so that when you forget who you are, it will reach out and remind you. So those are my prepared remarks. And I'm wondering if we do have, 5 minutes for questions, Brett? We have 15. Before we go to questions and comments and discussion or whatever you want to do, I'd like to just take a couple of minutes and take refuge silently together, if we could. Would anyone like to share anything? Renee, and then you.
First of all, I want to thank you because your teaching for me was very, very clear. And I'm not confused. And that's so special to me when I go into things. I really follow every step of the way. And so thank you for the time and the heart that you put into this teaching. The one place I got confused, and I'm sorry if most people know the answer to this. I don't understand how a knife is Buddha or an inanimate object, as we are taught, is Buddha.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. One of the fundamental, probably the fundamental delusion, the fundamental ignorance we have, is that we are separate. That we're separate, distinct beings. In fact, we are not. You could say we are all part of one another, but even that doesn't really get to the reality that it's all universe. Literally, it's all universe. Thich Nhat Hanh has a lovely teaching that if you look closely enough at this paper, you will see the sunshine and the tree and the air. I once asked Norm Randolph, the senior Dharma teacher at Dharma Field, what qualifies as a being, right? We talk about all beings. I want to know exactly, right? Everything, he says. He picked up a bookmark. This is a being. It's all universe. It's all universe. And that belief we hold that we are not that is the source of tremendous suffering. That's my short answer. The longer answer, the more important answer is just sit with that. Just observe it. Just observe it. It is possible to glimpse that. It is possible. Thank you. Oh, yes.
Sounds as though what you're expressing is that the refuge is trinary, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha together. And I find that at times I may be more needing to take refuge in the Sangha. I may be isolating, being alone. And sometimes I need to take a look at the teaching because my suffering
yes.
is particular to my thinking.
Yes.
And maybe other times taking more refuge in the Buddha and just a sense of my own Buddha nature and being there. So
yes.
I kind of working to balance those things, but separately they can be tools, jewels as tools for my own daily participating in the tension of that which is full enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And that refuge is maybe actually just being in the tension, not surrendering to. But I don't know that for sure. Maybe the Buddha actually surrendered completely and was disengaged from the tension. I think that there's a lot there to kind of study and work with in those deeper states. Is it really beyond the tension of my nature and my humanity? Or
Well, those things aren't separate. Buddha nature and your humanity are not separate. And I'm really glad you brought up this, well, trinary. I hadn't thought of that word, but I did think, I think that's really important and really well said, the way that you draw on each of the three at different times according to your causes and conditions of your life. I also think that there's a way to look at Buddha, Dharma, Sangha as a mindset where we take, where we develop the discipline and the wisdom and the compassion to take that mindset into the world and to see Buddha everywhere. To resolve that we will learn the lessons in our daily lives that are offered to us, that we sometimes think are bummers, sometimes are bummers. What's the Dharma lesson there? And that we learn to see, as I had the fortune to see, that Sangha is a broad community. Does that help you? I don't know if I addressed your question at all, but I appreciate your comment. Anne.
As you were describing so beautifully your moment of Dharma grace.
Yeah.
The garden, what other element in that came to me? It was, you know, there was that, you know, that state of being all in the weeds, and there was the undim, that grace of being tapped on the shoulder. But there was one element you didn't speak of, which was you received. You opened yourself, you listened. And I just think that was one additional piece that you didn't speak of. And that part of practice, I believe, is conditioning ourselves to receive, to be receptive and open.
Thank you. Yes, 100%. Those words are in the written version that I wanted, that I did want to receive it. I did. I recognized it and I wanted to receive it. It felt like home, which is, of course, refuge. So thank you, Anne. Did everybody hear her point about receptivity being a big part of practice? Thanks. Yeah. That's all right. You. All right.
I'm new to the practice.
Eric, I'm sorry. Yes.
I'm new to the practice, and I'm struggling with the terminology.
Okay.
Because they're not English terms. So saying something like, if I have refuge in the Buddha, and I got to remember Dharma, Net, Sangha, right now doesn't mean anything. And I was wondering what your insight is.
Tathagata, yeah, understandable.
So how, I assume that it will come to a point with repetition where I get that click.
Well, let me just ask you what it felt like to repeat it in the just couple of minutes we did here.
Distance, removed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like curiosity.
Yeah, good. Curiosity is a great quality in this practice. It's a great quality. Well, I would say you know, one of the Buddha's outstanding qualities, really, that I think we have to emulate is persistence. Oh my gosh. His story is one of amazing persistence. And And I think we have to do that. I think if you find a place that, if you find the practice stirs you in some way, if there's some recognition, go with it. Persist. Persist in saying the words. Persist in showing up. And then pay attention. I'm sorry, there's just really, everybody here has started practice and maybe persisted. Any thoughts anybody else has to offer, please do.
I recommend Suzuki Roshi. Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner Mind. It's really nicely displays about what the practice is about. And really, it's for beginners, and it really gives you a great idea of where we came from and what's going on.
You have something?
Yeah. Yes. I would like to share the Buddha Dharma Sangha. To me, I find the Buddha Dharma Sangha within everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's all wrapped up, all three are wrapped up within every single thing. For example, I can meditate outside, okay? Practicing Zazen, being mindful of my environment as it arises. And I can see Buddha. If a bird comes up, I can see Buddha in that bird. The presence of the bird, the Dharma, the teaching, I can be a student to that bird if I'm open. That bird is also part of my sangha, part of my community. And so therefore, I can find Buddha Dharma Sangha in everything around me. So therefore, I don't need to go anywhere. I can just be right where I'm at, and I can reach enlightenment right here, or awakening, or whatever level you're trying to achieve, just by being in your present moment. And that's all I want.
Thank you. I want to say one closing thing to Eric. The best advice I ever got when I was completely lost was just soak in it.
Yes, soak in it.
Soak in it. Just soak in it.